Welcome. You are listening to Genesius Guild's Classic Drama on the Air. This is your host, Misha Hooker, bringing you an hour of audio-only theater. Well, let's take theater in a slightly broader sense this time. This will be our second holiday special. We give you first a touching family Christmas story, Christmas at Red Butte, by Lucy Maud Montgomery, the author of Anne of Green Gables. This story is read by Dee Canfield and features a soundtrack composed of pieces from Music from a Hampshire Farm by Axletree. Next up is a Christmas meditation by Charles Dickens entitled A Christmas Tree, read by yours truly. In this piece, the author of A Christmas Carol offers, instead of a story, a set of reminiscences about the meaning of Christmas past, as he contemplates lifelong celebrations of presents and toys, books and stories, both silly and serious, including a long section on ghost stories. Of course, as A Christmas Carol itself reminds us, telling ghost stories was a major Christmas tradition in Victorian England, adding supernatural chills to the chills caused by the weather. The background music for this includes pieces from the Christmastime album by Bortex and numerous excerpts from the extensive guitar recordings of John Sayles, ranging from early music such as Guillaume Dufay to more modern works by Ravel and Fauré, as well as, of course, some Christmas carols. Details of the musical soundtracks are included in the episode notes, as are more details about some of the storybooks and plays beloved by Victorian children Dickens mentions. And now, without further ado, we wish you holiday cheer and offer you these sounds as wintry gifts for you and yours.
Christmas at Red Butte by Lucy Maud Montgomery. Of course Santa Claus will come, said Jimmy Martin confidently. Jimmy was 10, and at 10 it is easy to be confident. Why, he's got to come because it is Christmas Eve, and he always has come. You know that, twins. Yes, the twins knew it, and cheered by Jimmy's superior wisdom, their doubts passed away. There had been one terrible moment when Theodora had sighed and told them they mustn't be too much disappointed if Santa Claus did not come this year because the crops had been poor and he mightn't have had enough presents to go around. That doesn't make any difference to Santa Claus, scoffed Jimmy. You know as well as I do, Theodora Prentice, that Santa Claus is rich whether the crops fail or not. They failed 3 years ago before Father died, but Santa Claus came all the same. Probably you don't remember it, twins, because you were too little, but I do. Of course he'll come, so don't you worry a mite. And he'll bring my skates and your dolls. He knows we're expecting them, Theodora, because we wrote him a letter last week and threw it up the chimney. Candy and nuts, of course, and Mother's gone to town to buy a turkey. I tell you, we're going to have a ripping Christmas. Well, don't use such slangy words about it, Jimmy boy, sighed Theodora. She couldn't bear to dampen their hopes any further, and perhaps Aunt Elizabeth might manage it if the colt sold well. But Theodora had her painful doubts, and she sighed again as she looked out of the window, far down the trail that wound across the prairie, red-lighted by the declining sun of the short wintry afternoon. Do people always sigh like that when they get to be 16? Asked Jimmy curiously. You didn't sigh like that when you were only 15, Theodora. I wish you wouldn't. It makes me feel funny. And it's not a nice kind of funniness either. It's a bad habit I've got into lately, said Theodora, trying to laugh. Old folks are dull sometimes, you know, Jimmy boy. 16 is awful old, isn't it? Said Jimmy reflectively. I'll tell you what I'm going to do when I'm 16, Theodora. I'm going to pay off the mortgage and buy Mother a silk dress and a piano for the twins. Won't that be elegant? I'll be able to do that because I'm a man. Of course, if I was only a girl, I couldn't. I hope you'll be a good, kind, brave man and a real help to your mother, said Theodora softly, sitting down before the cozy fire and lifting the fat little twins onto her lap. Oh, I'll be good to her, never you fear, assured Jimmy, squatting comfortably down on the little fur rug before the stove, the skin of the coyote his father had killed 4 years ago. I believe in being good to your mother when you've only got the one. Now tell us a story, Theodora, a real jolly story, you know, with lots of fighting in it. Only please don't kill anybody. I like to hear about fighting, but I like to have all the people come out alive. Theodora laughed and began a story about the Riel Rebellion of 85, a story which had the double merit of being true and exciting at the same time. It was quite dark when she finished, and the twins were nodding, but Jimmy's eyes were wide open and sparkling. That was great, he said, drawing a long breath. Tell us another. No, it's bedtime for you all, said Theodora firmly. One story at a time is my rule, you know. But I want to sit up till Mother comes home, objected Jimmy. You can't. She may be very late, for she would have to wait to see Mr. Porter. Besides, you don't know what time Santa Claus might come, if he comes at all. If he were to drive along and see you children up instead of being sound asleep in bed, he might go right on and never call at all. This argument was too much for Jimmy. All right, we'll go, but we have to hang up our stockings first. Twins, go get yours. The twins toddled off in great excitement and brought back their Sunday stockings, which Jimmy proceeded to hang along the edge of the mantel shelf. This done, they all trooped obediently off to bed. Theodora gave another sigh and seated herself at the window where she could watch the moonlit prairie for Mrs. Martin's homecoming and knit at the same time. I'm afraid that you will think from all the sighing Theodora was doing that she was a very melancholy and despondent young lady. You couldn't think anything more unlike the real Theodora. She was the jolliest, bravest girl of 16 in all of Saskatchewan, as her shining brown eyes and rosy dimpled cheeks would have told you. And her sighs were not on her own account, but simply for fear the children were going to be disappointed. She knew that they would be almost heartbroken if Santa Claus did not come, and that this would hurt the patient, hard-working little mother more than all else. 5 years before this, Theodora had come to live with Uncle George and Aunt Elizabeth in the little log house at Red Butte. Her own mother had just died, and Theodora had only her big brother Donald left, and Donald had Klondike fever. The Martins were poor, but they had gladly made room for their little niece, and Theodora had lived there ever since, her aunt's right-hand girl and the beloved playmate of the children. They had been very happy until Uncle George's death 2 years before this Christmas Eve. But since then, there had been hard times in the little log house. And though Mrs. Martin and Theodora did their best, it was a woefully hard task to make both ends meet, especially this year when the crops had been poor. Theodora and her aunt had made every sacrifice possible for the children's sake, and at least Jimmy and the twins had not felt the pinch very severely yet. At 7, Mrs. Martin's bells jingled at the door, and Theodora flew out. Go right in and get warm, Auntie, she said briskly. I'll take Ned away and unharness him. It's a bitterly cold night, said Mrs. Martin wearily. There was a note of discouragement in her voice that struck dismay to Theodora's heart. I'm afraid it means no Christmas for the children tomorrow, she thought sadly as she led Ned away to the stable. When she returned to the kitchen, Mrs. Martin was sitting by the fire, her face in her chilled hand, sobbing convulsively. Auntie, oh, Auntie, don't! Exclaimed Theodora impulsively. It was such a rare thing to see her plucky, resolute little aunt in tears. You're cold and tired. I'll have a nice cup of tea for you in a trice. No, it isn't that, said Mrs. Martin brokenly. It was seeing those stockings hanging there. Theodora, I couldn't get a thing for the children, not a single thing. Mr. Porter would only give $40 for the colt, and when all the bills were paid, there was barely enough left for such necessaries as we must have. I suppose I ought to feel thankful I could get those. But the thought of the children's disappointment tomorrow is more than I can bear. It would have been better to have told them long ago, but I kept building on getting more for the colt. It's weak and foolish to give way like this. You better both take a cup of tea and go to bed. It will save fuel. When Theodora went up to her little room, her face was very thoughtful. She took a small box from her table and carried it to the window. In it was a very pretty little gold locket hung on a narrow blue ribbon. Theodora held it tenderly in her fingers and looked out over the moonlit prairie with a very sober face. Could she give up her dear locket? The locket Donald had given her just before he started for the Klondike. She had never thought she could do such a thing. It was almost the only thing she had to remind her of Donald. Handsome, merry, impulsive, warm-hearted Donald, who had gone away 4 years ago with a smile on his bonny face and splendid hope in his heart. "Here's a locket for you, gift of God," he had said gaily. He had such a dear, loving habit of calling her by the beautiful meaning of her name. A lump came into Theodora's throat as she remembered it. "I couldn't afford a chain, too, but when I come back, I'll bring you a rope of Klondike nuggets for it." Then he had gone away. For 2 years, letters had come from him regularly. Then he wrote that he had joined a prospecting party to a remote wilderness. After that was silence, deepening into anguish of suspense that finally ended in hopelessness. A rumor came that Donald Prentice was dead. None had returned from the expedition he had joined. Theodora had long ago given up all hope of ever seeing Donald again. Hence her locket was doubly dear to her. But Aunt Elizabeth had always been so good and loving and kind to her. Could she not make the sacrifice for her sake? Yes, she could and she would. Theodora flung up her head with a gesture that meant decision. She took out of the locket the bits of hair, her mother's and Donald's, which it contained. Perhaps a tear or two fell as she did so, and then hastily donned her warmest cap and wraps. It was only 3 miles to Spencer. She could easily walk it in an hour, and as it was Christmas Eve, the shops would be open late. She must walk, for Ned could not be taken out again, and the mare's foot was sore. Besides, Aunt Elizabeth must not know until it was done. As stealthily as if she were bound on some nefarious errand, Theodora slipped downstairs and out of the house. The next minute, she was hurrying along the trail in the moonlight. The great dazzling prairie was around her, the mystery and splendor of the northern night all about her. It was very calm and cold, but Theodora walked so briskly that she kept warm. The trail from Red Butte to Spencer was a lonely one. Mr. Lurgan's house, halfway to town, was the only dwelling on it. When Theodora reached Spencer, she made her way at once to the only jewelry store the little town contained. Mr. Benson, its owner, had been a friend of her uncle's, and Theodora felt sure that he would buy her locket. Nevertheless, her heart beat quickly, and her breath came and went uncomfortably fast as she went in. Suppose he wouldn't buy it? Then there would be no Christmas for the children at Red Butte. "Good evening, Miss Theodora," said Mr. Benson briskly. "What can I do for you?"
"I'm
I'm afraid I'm not a very welcome sort of customer, Mr. Benson, said Theodora with an uncertain smile. I want to sell, not buy. Will you buy this locket? Mr. Benson pursed up his lips, took up the locket, and examined it. Well, I don't often buy secondhand stuff, he said after some reflection, but I don't mind obliging you, Miss Theodora. I'll give you $4 for this trinket. Theodora knew the locket had cost a great deal more than that, but $4 would get what she wanted, and she dared not ask for more. In a few minutes, the locket was in Mr. Benson's possession, and Theodora, with 4 crisp new bills in her purse, was hurrying to the toy store. Half an hour later, she was on her way back to Red Butte with as many parcels as she could carry. Jimmy's skates, 2 lovely dolls for the twins, packages of nuts and candy, and a nice, plump turkey. Theodora beguiled her lonely tramp by picturing the children's joy in the morning. About a quarter of a mile past Mr. Lurgan's house, the trail curved suddenly about a bluff of poplars. As Theodora rounded the turn, she halted in amazement. Almost at her feet, the body of a man was lying across the road. He was clad in a big fur coat and had a fur cap pulled well down over his forehead and ears. Almost all of him that could be seen was a full bushy beard. Theodora had no idea who he was or where he had come from, but she realized that he was unconscious and that he would speedily freeze to death if help were not brought. The footprints of a horse galloping across the prairie suggested a fall and a runaway, but Theodora did not waste time in speculation. She ran back at full speed to Mr. Lurgan's and roused the household. In a few minutes, Mr. Lurgan and his son had hitched a horse to the wood sleigh and hurried down the trail to the unfortunate man. Theodora, knowing that her assistance was not needed and that she ought to get home as quickly as possible, went on her way as soon as she had seen the stranger in safekeeping. When she reached the little log house, she crept in cautiously, put the children's gifts in their stockings, placed the turkey on the table where Aunt Elizabeth would see it first thing in the morning, and then slipped off to bed, a very weary but very happy girl. The joy that reigned in the little log house the next day more than repaid Theodora for her sacrifice. Whoopee! Didn't I tell you that Santa Claus would come all right? Shouted the delighted Jimmy. Oh, what splendid skates! The twins hugged their dolls in silent rapture, but Aunt Elizabeth's face was the best of all. Then the dinner had to be prepared, and everybody had a hand in that. Just as Theodora, after a grave peep in the oven, had announced that the turkey was done, a sleigh dashed around the house. Theodora flew to answer the knock at the door, and there stood Mr. Lurgan and a big, bewhiskered, fur-coated fellow whom Theodora recognized as the stranger she had found on the trail. But was he a stranger? There was something oddly familiar in those merry brown eyes. Theodora felt herself growing dizzy. Donald, she gasped. Oh, Donald! And then she was in the big fellow's arms, laughing and crying at the same time. Donald it was indeed. And then followed half an hour during which everybody talked at once, and the turkey would have been burned to a crisp had it not been for the presence of mind of Mr. Lurgan, who, being the least excited of them all, took it out of the oven and set it on the back of the stove. To think that it was you last night and that I never dreamed of it, exclaimed Theodora. Oh, Donald, if I had gone to town. I'd have frozen to death, I'm afraid, said Donald soberly. I got into Spencer on the last train last night. I felt that I must come right out. I couldn't wait till morning. But there wasn't a team to be got for love or money. It was Christmas Eve and all the livery rigs were out. So I came on horseback. Just by that bluff, something frightened my horse, and he shied violently. I was half asleep and thinking of my little sister, and I went off like a shot. I suppose I struck my head against a tree. Anyway, I knew nothing more until I came to in Mr. Lurgan's kitchen. I wasn't much hurt, feel none the worse of it except for a sore head and shoulder. But oh, gift of God, how you have grown! I can't realize that you are the little sister I left 4 years ago. I suppose you have been thinking I was dead? Yes. And oh, Donald, where have you been? Well, I went way up north with a prospecting party. We had a tough time the first year, I can tell you, and some of us never came back. We weren't in a country where post offices were lying around loose either, you see. Then at last, just as we were about giving up in despair, we struck it rich. I brought a snug little pile home with me, and things are gonna look up in this log house, gift of God. There'll be no more worrying for you, dear people, over mortgages. I'm so glad, for Auntie's sake, said Theodora with shining eyes. But, oh, Donald, it's best of all just to have you back. I'm so perfectly happy that I don't know what to do or say. Well, I think you might have dinner, said Jimmy in an injured tone. The turkey's getting stone cold, and I'm most starving. I can't stand it another minute. So with a laugh, they all sat down to the table and ate the merriest Christmas dinner the little log house had ever known.
Christmas Tree by Charles Dickens. I have been looking on this evening at a merry company of children assembled round that pretty German toy, a Christmas tree. The tree was planted in the middle of a great round table and towered high above their heads. It was brilliantly lighted by a multitude of little tapers and everywhere sparkled and glittered with bright objects. There were rosy-cheeked dolls hiding behind the green leaves, and there were real watches, with movable hands at least, and an endless capacity of being wound up, dangling from innumerable twigs. There were French-polished tables, chairs, bedsteads, wardrobes, 8-day clocks, and various other articles of domestic furniture, wonderfully made in tin at Wolverhampton, perched among the boughs, as if in preparation for some fairy housekeeping. There were jolly, broad-faced little men, much more agreeable in appearance than many real men, and no wonder, for their heads took off and showed them to be full of sugar plums. There were fiddles and drums. There were tambourines, books, work boxes, paint boxes, sweetmeat boxes, peep show boxes, and all kinds of boxes. There were trinkets for the elder girls, far brighter than any grown-up gold and jewels. There were baskets and pincushions in all devices. There were guns, swords, and banners. There were witches standing in enchanted rings of pasteboard to tell fortunes. There were teetotums, humming tops, needle cases, pen wipers, smelling bottles, conversation cards, bouquet holders. Real fruit made artificially dazzling with gold leaf. Imitation apples, pears, and walnuts crammed with surprises, in short, as a pretty child before me delightedly whispered to another pretty child, her bosom friend, there was everything and more. This motley collection of odd objects, clustering on the tree like magic fruit, and flashing back the bright looks directed towards it from every side. Some of the diamond eyes admiring it were hardly on a level with the table, and a few were languishing in timid wonder on the bosoms of pretty mothers, aunts, and nurses, made a lively realization of the fancies of childhood, and set me thinking how all the trees that grow and all the things that come into existence on the earth have their wild adornments at that well-remembered time. Being now at home again and alone, the only person in the house awake, my thoughts are drawn back, by a fascination which I do not care to resist to my own childhood. I begin to consider what do we all remember best upon the branches of the Christmas tree of our own young Christmas days by which we climbed to real life. Straight in the middle of the room, cramped in the freedom of its growth by no encircling walls or soon-reached ceiling, a shadowy tree arises, and, looking up into the dreamy brightness of its top, for I observe in this tree the singular property that it appears to grow downward towards the earth, I look into my youngest Christmas recollections. All toys, at first, I find. Up yonder, among the green holly and red berries, is the tumbler, with his hands in his pockets, who wouldn't lie down, but whenever he was put upon the floor, persisted in rolling his fat body about until he rolled himself still, and brought those lobster eyes of his to bear upon me, when I affected to laugh very much, but in my heart of hearts was extremely doubtful of him. Close beside him is that infernal snuffbox, out of which there sprang a demoniacal counselor in a black gown, with an obnoxious head of hair and a red cloth mouth, wide open, who was not to be endured on any terms, but could not be put away either, for he used suddenly, in a highly magnified state, to fly out of mammoth snuffboxes in dreams, when least expected. Nor is the frog with cobbler's wax on his tail far off, for there was no knowing where he wouldn't jump. And when he flew over the candle and came upon one's hand with that spotted back red on a green ground, he was horrible. The cardboard lady in a blue silk skirt, who was stood up against the candlestick to dance, and whom I see on the same branch, was milder and was beautiful. But I can't say as much for the larger cardboard man, who used to be hung against the wall and pulled by a string. There was a sinister expression in that nose of his, and when he got his legs round his neck, which he very often did, he was ghastly and not a creature to be alone with. When did that dreadful mask first look at me? Who put it on, and why was I so frightened that the sight of it is an era in my life? It is not a hideous visage in itself. It is even meant to be droll. Why, then, were its stolid features so intolerable? Surely not because it hid the wearer's face. An apron would have done as much, and though I should have preferred even the apron away, it would not have been absolutely insupportable like the mask. Was it the immovability of the mask? The doll's face was immovable, but I was not afraid of her. Perhaps that fixed and set change coming over a real face infused into my quickened heart some remote suggestion and dread of the universal change that is to come on every face and make it still. Nothing reconciled me to it. No drummers, from whom proceeded a melancholy chirping on the turning of a handle, no regiment of soldiers with a mute band taken out of a box and fitted one by one upon a stiff and lazy little set of lazy tongs, no old woman made of wires and a brown paper composition cutting up a pie for two small children, could give me a permanent comfort for a long time. Nor was it any satisfaction to be shown the mask and see that it was made of paper, or to have it locked up and be assured that no one wore it. The mere recollection of that fixed face, the mere knowledge of its existence anywhere, was sufficient to awake me in the night all perspiration and horror with, "Oh, I know it's coming! Oh, the mask!" I never wondered what the dear old donkey with the panniers, there he is, was made of then. His hide was real to the touch, I recollect, and the great black horse with the round red spots all over him, the horse that I could even get upon, I never wondered what had brought him to that strange condition, or thought that such a horse was not commonly seen at Newmarket. The four horses of no color next to him that went into the wagon of cheeses and could be taken out and stabled under the piano appeared to have bits of fur tippet for their tails and other bits for their manes and to stand on pegs instead of legs, but it was not so when they were brought home for a Christmas present. They were all right then. Neither was their harness unceremoniously nailed into their chests, as appears to be the case now. The tinkling works of the music cart I did find out to be made of quill toothpicks and wire, and I always thought that little tumbler in his shirt sleeves, perpetually swarming up one side of a wooden frame and coming down head foremost on the other, rather a weak-minded person, though good-natured. But the Jacob's ladder next him, made of little squares of red wood that went flapping and clattering over one another, each developing a different picture, and the whole enlivened by small bells, was a mighty marvel and a great delight. Ah, the doll's house, of which I was not proprietor, but where I visited. I don't admire the Houses of Parliament half so much as that stone-fronted mansion with real glass windows and doorsteps and a real balcony, greener than I ever see now, except at watering places. And even they afford but a poor imitation. And though it did open all at once, the entire house front, which was a blow, I admit, as cancelling the fiction of a staircase, it was but to shut it up again, and I could believe. Even open, there were three distinct rooms in it, a sitting room and bedroom, elegantly furnished, and best of all, a kitchen, with uncommonly soft fire irons, a plentiful assortment of diminutive utensils, oh, the warming pan, and a tin man-cook in profile, who was always going to fry two fish. What Barmecide justice have I done to the noble feasts wherein the set of wooden platters figured, each with its own peculiar delicacy, as a ham or turkey, glued tight onto it, and garnished with something green which I recollect as moss? Could all the temperance societies of these later days, united, give me such a tea-drinking as I have had through the means of yonder little set of blue crockery, which really would hold liquid? It ran out of the small wooden cask, I recollect, and tasted of matches, and which made tea nectar. And if the two legs of the ineffectual little sugar tongs did tumble over one another and want purpose like Punch's hands, what does it matter? And if I did once shriek out as a poisoned child, and strike the fashionable company with consternation by reason of having drunk a little teaspoon inadvertently dissolved in too hot tea, I was never the worse for it, except by a powder. Upon the next branches of the tree, lower down, hard by the green roller and miniature gardening tools, how thick the books begin to hang! Thin books in themselves at first, but many of them, and with deliciously smooth covers of bright red or green. What fat black letters to begin with! A was an archer and shot at a frog. Of course he was. He was an apple pie also, and there he is. He was a good many things in his time, was A, and so were most of his friends, except X, who had so little versatility that I never knew him to get beyond Xerxes or Xantippe, like Y, who was always confined to a yacht or a yew tree, and Z, condemned forever to be a zebra or a zany. But now the very tree itself changes and becomes a beanstalk, the marvelous beanstalk up which Jack climbed to the giant's house. And now those dreadfully interesting double-headed giants with their clubs over their shoulders begin to stride along the boughs in a perfect throng, dragging knights and ladies home for dinner by the hair of their heads. And Jack, how noble, with his sword of sharpness and his shoes of swiftness! Again those old meditations come upon me as I gaze up at him, and I debate within myself whether there was more than one Jack, which I am loath to believe possible, or only one genuine, original, admirable Jack, who achieved all the recorded exploits. Good for Christmas time is the ruddy color of the cloak in which, the tree making a forest of itself for her to trip through with her basket, Little Red Riding Hood comes to me one Christmas Eve to give me information of the cruelty and treachery of that dissembling wolf who ate her grandmother, without making any impression on his appetite, and then ate her after making that ferocious joke about his teeth. She was my first love. I felt that if I could have married Little Red Riding Hood, I should have known perfect bliss. But it was not to be, and there was nothing for it but to look out the wolf in the Noah's Ark there and put him late in the procession on the table as a monster who was to be degraded. Oh, the wonderful Noah's Ark! It was not found seaworthy when put in a washing tub, and the animals were crammed in at the roof and needed to have their legs well shaken down before they could be got in, even there. And then, 10 to 1, but they began to tumble out at the door, which was but imperfectly fastened with a wire latch. But when was that against it? Consider the noble fly, a size or two smaller than the elephant, the ladybird, the butterfly, all triumphs of art. Consider the goose, whose feet were so small and whose balance was so indifferent that he usually tumbled forward and knocked down all the animal creation. Consider Noah and his family, like idiotic tobacco stoppers, and how the leopard stuck to warm little fingers, and how the tails of the larger animals used gradually to resolve themselves into frayed bits of string. Hush! Again, a forest, and somebody up in a tree, not Robin Hood, not Valentine, not the yellow dwarf, I have passed him and all Mother Bunch's wonders without mention, but an eastern king with a glittering scimitar and turban. By Allah, 2 eastern kings, for I see another looking over his shoulder. Down upon the grass at the tree's foot lies the full length of a coal-black giant, stretched asleep with his head in a lady's lap. And near them is a glass box, fastened with 4 locks of shining steel, in which he keeps the lady prisoner when he is awake. I see the 4 keys at his girdle now. The lady makes signs to the 2 kings in the tree, who softly descend. It is the setting in of the bright Arabian nights. Oh, now all common things become uncommon and enchanted to me. All lamps are wonderful, all rings are talismans. Common flower pots are full of treasure, with a little earth scattered on the top. Trees are for Ali Baba to hide in. Beefsteaks are to throw down into the Valley of Diamonds, that the precious stones may stick to them and be carried by the eagles to their nests, whence the traders, with loud cries, will scare them. Tarts are made, according to the recipe of the vizier's son of Bussorah, who turned pastry cook after he was set down in his drawers at the gate of Damascus. Cobblers are all Mustafa's, and in the habit of sewing up people cut into 4 pieces, to whom they are taken blindfold. Any iron ring let into stone is the entrance to a cave which only waits for the magician and the little fire and the necromancy that will make the earth shake. All the dates imported come from the same tree as that unlucky date with whose shell the merchant knocked out the eye of the genie's invisible son. All olives are the stock of that fresh fruit concerning which the commander of the faithful overheard the boy conduct the fictitious trial of the fraudulent olive merchant. All apples are akin to the apple purchased, with 2 others, from the sultan's gardener for 3 sequins, and which the tall black slave stole from the child. All dogs are associated with the dog, really a transformed man, who jumped upon the baker's counter and put his paw on the piece of bad money. All rice recalls the rice which the awful lady, who was a ghoul, could only peck by grains because of her nightly feasts in the burial place. My very rocking horse, there he is, with his nostrils turned completely inside out, indicative of blood, should have a peg in his neck, by virtue thereof, to fly away with me, as the wooden horse did with the Prince of Persia in the sight of all his father's court. Yes, on every object that I recognize among those upper branches of my Christmas tree, I see this fairy light. When I wake in bed at daybreak on the cold, dark winter mornings, the white snow dimly beheld outside through the frost on the window pane, I hear Dinarzad. Sister, sister, if you are yet awake, I pray you finish the history of the young king of the Black Islands. Scheherazade replies, if my lord the Sultan will suffer me to live another day, sister, I will not only finish that, but tell you a more wonderful story yet. Then the gracious Sultan goes out, giving no orders for the execution, and we all 3 breathe again. At this height of my tree, I begin to see, cowering among the leaves, it may be born of turkey, or of pudding, or mince pie, or of these many fancies, jumbled with Robinson Crusoe on his desert island, Philip Quarrel among the monkeys, Sanford and Merton with Mr. Barlow, Mother Bunch, and the mask. Or it may be the result of indigestion, assisted by imagination and over-doctoring, a prodigious nightmare. It is so exceedingly indistinct that I don't know why it's frightful, but I know it is. I can only make out that it is an immense array of shapeless things which appear to be planted on a vast exaggeration of the lazy tongs that used to bear the toy soldiers, and to be slowly coming close to my eyes and receding to an immeasurable distance. When it comes closest, it is worse. In connection with it, I descry remembrances of winter nights incredibly long, of being sent early to bed as a punishment for some small offense, and waking in 2 hours with a sensation of having been asleep 2 nights, of the laden hopelessness of morning ever dawning, and the oppression of a weight of remorse. And now I see a wonderful row of little lights rise smoothly out of the ground before a vast green curtain. Now a bell rings, a magic bell which still sounds in my ears unlike all other bells, and music plays amidst a buzz of voices and a fragrant smell of orange peel and oil. Anon, the magic bell commands the music to cease, and the great green curtain rolls itself up majestically, and the play begins. The devoted dog of Montargis avenges the death of his master, foully murdered in the forest of Bondy, and a humorous peasant with a red nose and a very little hat, whom I take from this hour forth to my bosom as a friend. I think he was a waiter or an ostler at a village inn, but many years have passed since he and I have met. Remarks that the sassagacity of that dog is indeed surprising, and evermore this jocular conceit will live in my remembrance fresh and unfading, overtopping all possible jokes unto the end of time. Or now I learn with bitter tears how poor Jane Shore, dressed all in white, and with her brown hair hanging down, went starving through the streets, or how George Barnwell killed the worthiest uncle that ever man had, and was afterwards so sorry for it that he ought to have been let off. Comes swift to comfort me the pantomime, stupendous phenomenon, when clowns are shot from loaded mortars into the great chandelier, bright constellation that it is, when harlequins, covered all over with scales of pure gold, twist and sparkle like amazing fish, when Pantaloon, whom I deem it no irreverence to compare in my own mind to my grandfather, puts red-hot pokers in his pocket and cries, "Here's somebody coming!" or taxes the clown with petty larceny by saying, "Now I saw you do it," when everything is capable with the greatest ease of being changed into anything, and nothing is but thinking makes it so. Now, too, I perceive my first experience of the dreary sensation, often to return in afterlife, of being unable, next day, to get back to the dull, settled world, of wanting to live forever in the bright atmosphere I have quitted, of doting on the little fairy, with the wand like a celestial barber's pole, and pining for a fairy immortality along with her. Ah, she comes back in many shapes as my eye wanders down the branches of my Christmas tree, and goes as often and has never yet stayed by me. Out of this delight springs the toy theater. There it is, with its familiar proscenium and ladies in feathers in the boxes, and all its attendant occupation with paste and glue and gum and watercolors in the getting up of the Miller and his men, and Elizabeth, or the Exile of Siberia. In spite of a few besetting accidents and failures, particularly an unreasonable disposition in the respectable Kelmar, and some others to become faint in the legs and double up at exciting points of the drama. A teeming world of fancies so suggestive and all-embracing that far below it on my Christmas tree I see dark, dirty, real theaters in the daytime, adorned with these associations as with the freshest garlands of the rarest flowers, and charming me yet. But hark! The Waits are playing, and they break my childish sleep. What images do I associate with the Christmas music as I see them set forth on the Christmas tree? No, before all the others, keeping far apart from all the others, they gather round my little bed. An angel speaking to a group of shepherds in a field, some travelers with eyes uplifted following a star, a baby in a manger, a child in a spacious temple talking with grave men, a solemn figure with a mild and beautiful face raising a dead girl by the hand. Again, near a city gate, calling back the son of a widow on his bier to life. A crowd of people looking through the opened roof of a chamber where he sits and letting down a sick person on a bed with ropes. The same in a tempest walking on the water to a ship, again on a seashore teaching a great multitude. Again with a child upon his knee and other children round, again restoring sight to the blind, speech to the dumb, hearing to the deaf, health to the sick, strength to the lame, knowledge to the ignorant. Again dying upon a cross, watched by armed soldiers, a thick darkness coming on, the earth beginning to shake, and only one voice heard, "Forgive them, for they know not what they do." Still on the lower and maturer branches of the tree, Christmas associations cluster thick. School books shut up, Ovid and Virgil silenced, the rule of three with its cool impertinent inquiries long disposed of. Terence and Plautus acted no more. In an arena of huddled desks and forms all chipped and notched and inked, cricket bats, stumps, and balls left higher up with the smell of trodden grass and the softened noise of shouts in the evening air. The tree is still fresh, still gay. If I no more come home at Christmas time, there will be boys and girls, thank heaven, while the world lasts, and they do. Yonder they dance and play upon the branches of my tree. God bless them merrily, and my heart dances and plays too. And I do come home at Christmas. We all do, or we all should. We all come home, or ought to come home, for a short holiday, the longer the better, from the great boarding school where we are forever working at our arithmetical slates to take and give a rest. As to going a-visiting, where can we not go if we will? Where have we not been when we would, starting our fancy from our Christmas tree? Away into the winter prospect, there are many such upon the tree. On by low-lying, misty grounds, through fens and fogs, up long hills, winding dark as caverns between thick plantations, almost shutting out the sparkling stars, so out on broad heights until we stop at last, with sudden silence, at an avenue. The gate bell has a deep, half-awful sound in the frosty air. The gate swings open on its hinges, and as we drive up to a great house, the glancing lights grow larger in the windows, and the opposing rows of trees seem to fall solemnly back on either side to give us place. At intervals all day, a frightened hare has shot across this whitened turf, or the distant clatter of a herd of deer trampling the hard frost has, for the minute, crushed the silence too. Their watchful eyes beneath the fern may be shining now, if we could see them, like the icy dewdrops on the leaves, but they are still, and all is still. And so the lights growing larger, and the trees falling back before us, and closing up again behind us, as if to forbid retreat, we come to the house. There is probably a smell of roasted chestnuts and other good, comfortable things all the time, for we are telling winter stories. Ghost stories, or more shame for us, round the Christmas fire, and we have never stirred except to draw a little nearer to it. But no matter for that. We came to the house, and it is an old house full of great chimneys, where wood is burnt on ancient dogs upon the hearth, and grim portraits, some of them with grim legends too, lower distrustfully from the oaken panels of the walls. We are a middle-aged nobleman, and we make a generous supper with our host and hostess and their guests, it being Christmas time and the old house full of company, and then we go to bed. Our room is a very old room. It is hung with tapestry. We don't like the portrait of a cavalier in green over the fireplace. There are great black beams in the ceiling, and there is a great black bedstead supported at the foot by two great black figures who seem to have come off a couple of tombs in the old baronial church in the park for our particular accommodation. But we are not a superstitious nobleman, and we don't mind. Well, we dismiss our servant, lock the door, and sit before the fire in our dressing gown, musing about a great many things. At length, we go to bed. Well, we can't sleep. We toss and tumble and can't sleep. The embers on the hearth burn fitfully and make the room look ghostly. We can't help peeping out over the counterpane at the two black figures and the cavalier, that wicked-looking cavalier in green. In the flickering light, they seem to advance and retire, which, though we are not by any means a superstitious nobleman, is not agreeable. Well, We get nervous, more and more nervous. We say, oh, this is very foolish, but we can't stand this. We'll pretend to be ill and knock up somebody. Well, we are just going to do it when the locked door opens and there comes in a young woman, deadly pale and with long, fair hair, who glides to the fire and sits down in the chair we have left there, wringing her hands. Then we notice that her clothes are wet. Our tongue cleaves to the roof of our mouth, and we can't speak, but we observe her accurately. Her clothes are wet. Her long hair is dabbled with moist mud. She is dressed in the fashion of 200 years ago, and she has at her girdle a bunch of rusty keys. Well, there she sits, and we can't even faint. We are in such a state about it. Presently, she gets up and tries all the locks in the room with the rusty keys, which won't fit one of them. Then she fixes her eyes on the portrait of the cavalier in green and says in a low, terrible voice, "The stags know it." After that, she wrings her hands again, passes the bedside, and goes out at the door. We hurry on our dressing gown, seize our pistols, we always travel with pistols, and are following when we find the door locked. We turn the key, look out into the dark gallery, no one there. We wander away and try to find our servant. Can't be done. We pace the gallery till daybreak, then return to our deserted room, fall asleep, and are awakened by our servant. Nothing ever haunts him. And the shining sun. Well, we make a wretched breakfast, and all the company say we look queer. After breakfast, we go over the house with our host, and then we take him to the portrait of the cavalier in green, and then it all comes out. He was false to a young housekeeper once attached to that family, and famous for her beauty, who drowned herself in a pond, and whose body was discovered after a long time because the stags refused to drink of the water, since which it has been whispered that she traverses the house at midnight, but goes especially to that room where the cavalier in green was wont to sleep, trying the old locks with the rusty keys. Well, we tell our host of what we have seen, and a shade comes over his features, and he begs it may be hushed up, and so it is. But it's all true, and we said so before we died. We are dead now, to many responsible people. There is no end to the old houses with resounding galleries and dismal state bedchambers and haunted wings shut up for many years through which we may ramble with an agreeable creeping up our back and encounter any number of ghosts, but, it is worthy of remark perhaps, reducible to a very few general types and classes, for ghosts have little originality and walk in a beaten track. Thus it comes to pass that a certain room in a certain old hall where a certain bad lord, baronet, knight, or gentleman shot himself has certain planks in the floor from which the blood will not be taken out. You may scrape and scrape as the present owner has done, or plane and plane as his father did, or scrub and scrub as his grandfather did, or burn and burn with strong acids as his great-grandfather did, but there the blood will still be, no redder and no paler, no more and no less, always just the same. Thus, in such another house there is a haunted door that never will keep open, or another door that never will keep shut, or a haunted sound of a spinning wheel, or a hammer, or a footstep, or a cry, or a sigh, or a horse's tramp, or the rattling of a chain. Or else there is a turret clock which, at the midnight hour, strikes 13, when the head of the family is going to die. Or a shadowy, immovable black carriage which, at such a time, is always seen by somebody, waiting near the great gates in the stable yard. Or thus it came to pass how Lady Mary went to pay a visit at a large wild house in the Scottish Highlands, and being fatigued with her long journey, retired to bed early, and innocently said next morning at the breakfast table, "How odd to have so late a party last night in this remote place, and not to tell me of it before I went to bed." Then everyone asked Lady Mary what she meant. Then Lady Mary replied, "Why, all night long the carriages were driving round and round the terrace underneath my window. Then the owner of the house turned pale, and so did his lady, and Charles MacDoodle of MacDoodle signed to Lady Mary to say no more, and everyone was silent. After breakfast, Charles MacDoodle told Lady Mary that it was a tradition in the family that those rumbling carriages on the terrace betokened death. And so it proved, for 2 months afterwards, the lady of the mansion died. And Lady Mary, who was a maid of honor at court, often told this story to the old Queen Charlotte, by this token that the old king always said, "Eh? Eh? What? What? Ghosts? Ghosts? No such thing. No such thing." And never left off saying so until he went to bed. Or, a friend of somebody's whom most of us know, when he was a young man at college, had a particular friend with whom he made the compact that if it were possible for the spirit to return to this earth after its separation from the body, he of the twain who first died should reappear to the other. In course of time, this compact was forgotten by our friend, the two young men having progressed in life and taken diverging paths that were wide asunder. But one night, many years afterwards, our friend, being in the north of England and staying for the night in an inn on the Yorkshire moors, happened to look out of bed, and there, in the moonlight, leaning on a bureau near the window, steadfastly regarding him, saw his old college friend. The appearance being solemnly addressed, replied, in a kind of whisper but very audibly, "Do not come near me. I am dead. I am here to redeem my promise. I come from another world, but may not disclose its secrets." Then, the whole form becoming paler, melted, as it were, into the moonlight, and faded away. Or there was the daughter of the first occupier of the picturesque Elizabethan house, so famous in our neighborhood. You have heard about her? No. Why, she went out one summer evening at twilight, when she was a beautiful girl, just 17 years of age, to gather flowers in the garden, and presently came running, terrified, into the hall to her father, saying, "Oh, dear father, I have met myself." He took her in his arms and told her it was fancy, but she said, "Oh, no, I met myself in the broad walk, and I was pale and gathering withered flowers, and I turned up my head and held them up." And that night she died. And a picture of her story was begun, though never finished, and they say it is somewhere in the house to this day, with its face to the wall. Or the uncle of my brother's wife was riding home on horseback one mellow evening at sunset, when, in a green lane close to his own house, he saw a man standing before him in the very center of a narrow way. "Why does that man in the cloak stand there?" he thought. "Does he want me to ride over him?" But the figure never moved. He felt a strange sensation at seeing it so still, but slackened his trot and rode forward. When he was so close to it as almost to touch it with his stirrup, his horse shied, and the figure glided up the bank in a curious, unearthly manner, backward and without seeming to use its feet, and was gone. The uncle of my brother's wife exclaiming, "Good heaven, it's my cousin Harry from Bombay," put spurs to his horse, which was suddenly in a profuse sweat, and wondering at such strange behavior, dashed round to the front of his house. There he saw the same figure, just passing in at the long French window of the drawing room, opening on the ground. He threw his bridle to a servant and hastened in after it. His sister was sitting there alone. "Alice, where's my cousin Harry?" "Your cousin Harry, John?" "Yes, from Bombay. I met him in the lane just now and saw him enter here this instant." Not a creature had been seen by anyone, and in that hour and minute, as it afterwards appeared, this cousin died in India. Or it was a certain sensible old maiden lady who died at 99 and retained her faculties to the last, who really did see the orphan boy, a story which has often been incorrectly told, but of which the real truth is this, because it is in fact a story belonging to our family, and she was a connection of our family. When she was about 40 years of age, and still an uncommonly fine woman, her lover died young, which was the reason why she never married, though she had many offers. She went to stay at a place in Kent, which her brother, an Indian merchant, had newly bought. There was a story that this place had once been held in trust by the guardian of a young boy, who was himself the next heir, and who killed the young boy by harsh and cruel treatment. She knew nothing of that. It has been said that there was a cage in her bedroom in which the guardian used to put the boy. There was no such thing. There was only a closet. She went to bed, made no alarm whatever in the night, and in the morning said composedly to her maid when she came in, "Who is the pretty, forlorn-looking child who has been peeping out of that closet all night?" The maid replied by giving a loud scream and instantly decamping. She was surprised, but she was a woman of remarkable strength of mind, and she dressed herself and went downstairs and closeted herself with her brother. "Now, Walter," she said, "I have been disturbed all night by a pretty, forlorn-looking boy who has been constantly peeping out of that closet in my room which I can't open. This is some trick." "I am afraid not, Charlotte," said he, "for it is the legend of the house. It is the orphan boy. What did he do?" "He opened the door softly," said she, "and peeped out. Sometimes he came a step or two into the room. Then I called to him to encourage him, and he shrunk and shuddered and crept in again and shut the door." "The closet has no communication, Charlotte," said her brother, "with any other part of the house, and it's nailed up." This was undeniably true, and it took two carpenters a whole forenoon to get it open for examination. Then she was satisfied that she had seen the orphan boy. But the wild and terrible part of the story is that he was also seen by three of her brother's sons in succession, who all died young. On the occasion of each child being taken ill, he came home in a heat 12 hours before and said, "Oh, Mama," he had been playing under a particular oak tree in a certain meadow with a strange boy, a pretty, forlorn-looking boy, who was very timid and made signs. From fatal experience, the parents came to know that this was the orphan boy, and that the course of that child whom he chose for his little playmate was surely run. Legion is the name of the German castles where we sit up alone to wait for the specter, where we are shown into a room made comparatively cheerful for our reception, where we glance round at the shadows thrown on the blank walls by the crackling fire, where we feel very lonely when the village innkeeper and his pretty daughter have retired after laying down a fresh store of wood upon the hearth and setting forth on the small table such supper cheer as a cold roast capon, bread, grapes, and a flask of old Rhine wine, where the reverberating doors close on their retreat one after another like so many peals of sullen thunder, and where, about the small hours of the night, we come into the knowledge of diverse supernatural mysteries. Legion is the name of the haunted German students, in whose society we draw yet nearer to the fire, while the schoolboy in the corner opens his eyes wide and round and flies off the footstool he has chosen for his seat when the door accidentally blows open. Vast is the crop of such fruit shining on our Christmas tree, in blossom, almost at the top, ripening all down the boughs. Among the later toys and fancies hanging there, as idle often and less pure, be the images once associated with the sweet old waits, the softened music in the night, ever unalterable. Encircled by the social thoughts of Christmas time, still let the benignant figure of my childhood stand unchanged. In every cheerful image and suggestion that the season brings, may the bright star that rested above the poor roof be the star of all the Christian world. A moment's pause, O vanishing tree, of which the lower boughs are dark to me as yet, and let me look once more. I know there are blank spaces on thy branches, where eyes that I have loved have shone and smiled, from which they are departed. But far above, I see the razor of the dead girl, and the widow's son, and God is good. If age be hiding for me in the unseen portion of thy downward growth, oh, may I, with a gray head, turn a child's heart to that figure yet, and a child's trustfulness and confidence. Now the tree is decorated with bright merriment and song and dance and cheerfulness, and they are welcome. Innocent and welcome be they ever held beneath the branches of the Christmas tree, which cast no gloomy shadow. But as it sinks into the ground, I hear a whisper going through the leaves. This, in commemoration of the law of love and kindness, mercy and compassion. This, in remembrance of me.